This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Stephen Hausman. I am an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I will be your host for today's interview. And I'm very excited today to be joined by Allison Rose Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson is an independent historian and is a heritage conservation consultant. She currently serves as the scholar in residence with the Institute for the Study of Los Angeles at Occidental College. And beginning this coming September, she will be the guest scholar in residence at the Getty Conservation Institute. And we're going to discuss her latest book, Living the California Dream, African American Leisure Sites During the Jim Crow Era, which came out just last year in 2020. With the University of Nebraska Press. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the New Books Network today, Allison.
And hello. Thank you so much for inviting me, Stephen, to participate in the program.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. We always like to begin on the show by just hearing a bit about the guests themselves. So tell us about yourself. What's your background? How did you become interested in history?
Well, I have always been interested in history since I was a child. And that may sound a little cliche, but it's true. I was around a lot of adults when I was growing up, and they used to take me to all kinds of events that had history-making consequences, as well as events that were about current, that had history-making consequences, that would be the better way to put it, as well as to all kinds of cultural programs. As an adult, I always, before I became a historian, before I went back to school to get this PhD to be a historian and write this book, I had worked in other fields, but I was always doing research, and I was always learning about things to do with history and contemporary culture. And one day, after several experiences working in the cultural fields of art and music, and also working with historic buildings, I decided to get a master's degree in heritage conservation from the University of Southern California. And then I was working on a thesis to do with one of the sites that I cover in my book, my master's thesis project, Lake Elsinore. And I worked in, I went to work for a heritage conservation firm, Historic Resources Group. And while I was there doing that work in heritage conservation, looking at buildings and preserving the past and the stories associated with those buildings, I realized that I wanted a broader platform to work in, from the standpoint that there were many stories that I wanted to tell about African American heritage that were not necessarily tied to a physical structure, tangible heritage. They weren't tied to material integrity in terms of architecture. And so that was what inspired me to go back and get a PhD in history from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And as I was doing my coursework and thinking about American history in the broader sense of what American history is, I still moved forward in terms of learning about the African-American experience in California around places that I had begun to look at when I was working on my master's degree in heritage conservation. And that is what evolved into the book, Living the California Dream, African-American Leisure Sites During the Jim Crow Era. There's just so many stories that are out there, and they're not all tied to buildings. And so going into another phase of being a historian was the the best of all possible worlds for me.
I'm curious about the conservation work that you do, because you know, often I have historians on the podcast who most of their job is you know, teaching classes and going to faculty meetings and writing books, and I don't talk on the show to many people that do the kind of conservation work that you do. And you mentioned that you're interested in places in particular as opposed to kind of architectural conservation. Could you talk a little bit about that kind of distinction? And in the book, you use the phrase a lot, placemaking, which I really liked as a concept. Could you tell us a bit more about that and how it fits into your larger work as a conservation historian?
So in terms of this particular project, the Living the California Dream project, it is about reinserting the African-American experience in places throughout Southern California. And I don't consider myself... what did you call me? What did you called me something
conservation historian?
I don't necessarily consider myself a conservation historian.
Okay.
But I am a heritage conservation consultant, and heritage conservation is, in the broader sense of the word, looking at interpretation of place and placemaking, as well, and those are the social, looking at the social stories that make a place, as well as if there is a building or some other kind of structure or a landscape that can be interpreted at that particular place. So it's a much broader term that is used more in the worldwide vernacular for what Americans generally call heritage, what Americans generally call historic preservation, which is very, very tied to architecture, to a tangible structure, and interpreting the social experience through the architectural form, through the design. And in most of the stories of placemaking that I am dealing with this project, Living the California Dream, the places don't have tangible sites. They have social stories at these sites where buildings may have been torn down, or where, in terms of, there's a beach site in Santa Monica, and there's a beach site in Manhattan Beach that I cover in the book, and in a few other places in Southern California, that there's no structures there to talk about what the social experience was of people coming to those sites. And in some cases, the beach has actually changed because there's been beach nourishment campaigns from the 1940s through the 1950s that widened the beach. So it's a different landscape than it was when it was the heyday of African Americans hanging out, for instance, in Santa Monica at the Bay Street Beach. And for that matter, even at Manhattan Beach in South Los Angeles County, where one of the areas, Bruce's Beach, was located, they've changed the landscape a little bit from what it looked like when the Bruce's Resort was at its height between the first decade of the 20th century, first few decades of the 20th century. So with that, just to recap, it is looking at the social community values of a place versus looking at the place in terms of a building and those values.
And what drew you to the topic of this book? It sounds like it's been a long-term project that you've been working on for quite a while, but what is sort of the genesis here? What drew you to the topic of African-American leisure sites and their memory in Southern California in particular?
So my mother's family moved to Los Angeles in the mid-1920s. And my mother and her two brothers, my mother was Marcelin, her brothers were Price and Prince, and her parents were Rosa and Peter Price Cobbs. And so they had their, my grandparents had their children here, and they would have been folks that were living in the old East Side neighborhoods of Los Angeles, and they would have been going to some of these places that I talk about in my book. And in particular, my mother had experiences with my grandparents when she was growing up, going to Lake Elsinore. And she and her brothers and my grandmother, my grandfather was dead by the time I was born, they on occasion would talk about this experience of going to Lake Elsinore. And they also took us on a family outing where all of us, my cousins, my grandmother, my uncles and aunts, we went to Lake Elsinore to hang out at the lake in the 60s. And it was right after they had stabilized the water. And it was really a very fun family trip. And it was one of the few family trips that we took like that, where we hung out for a day, where we weren't at somebody's house. And so I had that kind of bug in my brain about the place then. And then at another time in the late 60s, we went out to Lake Elsinore again to visit a distant cousin who lived out there. And so I always was interested in knowing more about the experience, but at that, as a college student and in my early working career, I didn't really have any reason to learn more about it, particularly at that point in time. But then when I became a graduate student working on my master's degree, I had to come up with some paper topics. And so I thought, oh, well, let me look at this Lake Elsinore area. I've always wanted to know more about it. And so that's how I came to thinking about the topic when I was working on my master's degree. And I learned about these other places that I cover in the book at that time as well. And when I started working on my master's degree in 2003, and I finished in 2007, I didn't realize that I was going to go on to get a PhD. I thought I was going to get the master's degree, and then I was going to work in heritage conservation for the duration of my career, or historic preservation. And so I did a cursory paper where I explored all of the African-American leisure sites, and then some that I cover in my book, in a class that I took with Kevin Starr, who many of your listeners will know was one of the deans of California history. And he wrote the books, the California Dream series of several books that covered the history of California from the late 1800s until the end of the 20th century. And so I took this class with him, and when I was searching around for my paper topic for his class, I went to him with this idea about these leisure sites, and I went to him with another idea of looking at the Mission Inn and Frank, I'm spacing on the guy's name who was the proprietor of that building, but he was an entrepreneur and he was very creative in terms of developing that hotel, and I was interested to know a little bit more about him. And so I went to start with these two ideas, look at the Mission Inn and look at these leisure sites. And he was like, ah, everybody's done something on the Mission Inn, but these leisure sites and the African-American experience, nobody's done much on, nobody's done anything on that. And I don't know anything about that. You should write about that. So that was my encouragement to pursue the direction from someone who I love his work, and he was a great, for me, he was a great teacher, a great professor, and he died, unfortunately, before the book came out, but he knew I had gotten to the PhD level and had gotten the dissertation. I think he died, I can't remember when he died right now, whether I was in progress on the PhD or whether it was done, but he didn't know that the book came out. I'll just say that. And so he helped to, you know, encourage me to think about the work from the standpoint of something that people didn't know about. And I had an inkling at that point in time that I wanted to do research on something that was going to be meaningful to me. That's not the inkling, but I wanted to do research on something that was going to be meaningful to me. And my inkling was, you know, I don't want to just do a paper just to do a paper to satisfy my requirements. I want to do a paper that is going to have some sort of longevity in terms of things that I might revisit, in terms of expanding what work I had done on it. Now, I didn't know that I was going to get a PhD, but, you know, that was kind of in the back of my mind. And while I was in graduate school, working on the master's degree, my professor and advisor, Ken Breisch, in Heritage Conservation, suggested to me that I look at getting a PhD when he was reading my initial drafts of my thesis. And he said, go talk to the people in the history department and in American studies at USC. And I did, but I was like, I have to finish this. I have to finish this master's thesis and get this degree. I can't be thinking about a PhD. And they were so disorganized at that point in terms of the departments, because they were, you know how at different times your departments are having turnover and they're reevaluating programs and what have you. And so it just wasn't necessarily a good time for somebody like me to be talking to a department. So I went on and got a job with Historic Resources Group. But those are the things that, you know, initially got me to the topics. And you know, doing the research initially, I then began talking to various individuals in the African-American community whose families had been in Los Angeles as long or longer than my grandparents had been here. And then I was learning lots of information from them. And then they were showing me photographs and sharing other tidbits of information that I hadn't seen in public archives before. And I really was engaged with learning about this history. And I knew something about Los Angeles history, but I certainly didn't know as much as I have learned, as much as I learned in those early years of graduate school. And at that time, also, There were a few books that had come out that were more contemporary books about the African-American experience in terms of the music scene. And Doug Flamming had done his book in 2005, Bound for Freedom. And so there was, and then in terms of Santa Monica, Paula Scott had done a book about Santa Monica, which was more expansive in terms of looking at a fuller experience of what the Santa Monica history was, including communities of color and other marginalized groups. And so it was kind of at an intersection of my interests and things that were going on in the broader realm of academic scholarship that maybe were working around in my subconscious to engage me, to help me to push forward eventually to getting the PhD.
And I think that's good advice for anyone looking to write a book is, you know, write about something that you care about. Like the topic will go from there, but it sounds like you started with something that you were interested in and it just went from there. And that seems like good advice for anyone looking to write a long-term large scale project like this.
Well, I would think so. And it's funny in terms of us having this conversation, because in the last couple of years, there have been a few things that have been presented to me, and I've thought, oh, well, that would be kind of interesting to, you know, look at. And then after I started doing the research for preliminary proposals, I realized that I wasn't intellectually engaged enough with the material and emotionally engaged enough with the material that I really wanted to continue with it. And I just was with talking with a friend yesterday, a scholarly colleague, and she got roped into doing this project. And she said, I should have never told them I would do this.
Yeah, it has to hold your attention for many years. And if it's not going to do that, it'll just, you know, it'll wear you out.
Yes, yes, I'm with you there.
Well, let's get into the book a little bit. And why don't we begin, just as you do in the book, by just setting the context. Tell us about California, and specifically about Southern California in the early 20th century. I'm curious about this idea of the California dream, as you describe it, and just kind of in a broader sense, what life was like in Southern California, in particular for African-American Californians during the Jim Crow era.
Well, California, and Los Angeles, Southern California in general, were really areas that were developing in the 20th century rather than the 19th century. I mean, there were people here in the 19th century, but the train didn't get here until the 1880s in terms of Los Angeles area. It was in San Diego first and then Los Angeles. And it had been in, the train had come to San Francisco earlier. And San Francisco and the Bay Area was where the gold rush was. And so that's where many people were first attracted to coming to California during the American period. Now, there were people during the Spanish and Mexican period all over California, but they were really in small numbers. And Los Angeles was the center of the frontier at that point in time. And so in terms of the 20th century, this area then got the train and it became the hub of life for the region. And for African Americans, it also became the hub of life. It became the population center for the general population, and it became the largest population center for African Americans in the West, and one of the two largest population centers in California. And the other one was the Bay Area. And then the third one would have been San Diego. And so with that, African Americans, just like whites, were moving to Southern California for the climate, for the beautiful landscape and new life opportunities. And with those new life opportunities, they were looking to invest in real estate. And then African Americans also were looking to move here to escape the worst of the Jim Crow era Black racist restrictions. There was much more freedom that they were able to have here in California, even though there was still discrimination in California. And one of the things that helped to lessen the discrimination was that California had civil rights laws that were on the books as early as the as 1893, even if they weren't always enforced. So that helped. And folks could buy property here. Black people could buy property here. Their children could go to school more easily than in other places. And so it made for a place that some people wanted to come. Now, it was a long way for a lot of people to get to Los Angeles. You had to have a little money to get here because it wasn't an established route of people coming to migrate. There wasn't a lot of industry here. Most of the jobs that African Americans were getting were in the urban service kinds of jobs. So it would have been, low-level maintenance and servant jobs, and then also low-level jobs in terms of labor. And then there were some professionals here, doctors and lawyers, and small businessmen were able to establish businesses, and a few large businesses got established. Some of them lasted through the end of the through the early decades of the 21st century. And then there were many people that were able to buy their own homes, as I said, buy property, but they also were able to buy other pieces of property within, you know, their means. And that helped to build some wealth, because everyone was a real estate speculator then as now. many people are still speculating in real estate in terms of their home and other pieces of property. And this is a place that then in the early 20th century, as it is today, is still someplace that a lot of people want to move to because they like the weather, for one, and they're interested in the employment opportunities that have developed over the last 100 years. So it was a better place to be for many people. And by 1918, Los Angeles had established a community where they were able to, with some of their multi-ethnic neighbors, elect the first African-American to the assembly in 1918. That was Frederick Madison Roberts. And that seat has still remained held by an African-American even to this day. And so that was something that was encouraging people to come here as well. The jazz scene was blooming because the movie industry was here. African-American musicians were able to get jobs playing in the films, and there were a few opportunities for African-American actors and actresses. There were a few film companies that were formed by Black people. But really, in terms of the businesses that African-Americans got into, it was more real estate and small businesses, restaurants, small restaurants and beauty salons and hair salons. And they were doing real estate transactions, and they were in building And then the larger businesses that got formed were Liberty Savings and Loan, which lasted through the 1960s, and the Golden State Mutual Life Insurance Company. And then one business that was formed in the 1920s that's still around today is Angela's Funeral Home. And they've expanded from their original funeral home business to now own a cemetery. And those were so as people moved here, they encouraged a few other people to move here. And so Los Angeles is still the largest population center, or Southern California, is still the largest population center of African Americans in the West.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And in the book, you talk about 5 or 6 individual leisure sites, and you have a lot of really great stories about each one in there. You talk about both the history of these places, the placemaking process itself, and the memory of these places as well. We probably don't have time to talk about the details of every single one, but I'm hoping that you can maybe provide an overview of each of these sites that you talk about in depth in the book. And maybe we can start by talking a bit about Manhattan Beach, California, and the site of Bruce's Beach. What is the story of this place, and what is its memory today, and the contestation around its memory today?
So Bruce's Beach has captured the imagination of the globe today, because it was an early African-American resort that began in 1912, and it was founded by a woman entrepreneur with her husband, Willa Bruce, with her husband, Charles Bruce. And it it was, by all accounts, it became very successful. And it lasted from 1912 to the 1920s. And it was a business that started out with pop-up tents, and then eventually got a few buildings. And they had a dance hall, a cafe, and they had rooms to change your clothes for, enjoying the beach. And when the business first opened, it had contestation from the white folks that were in the area. They didn't want the black people to have this resort, and they protested by putting up ropes in front of the property so that the people couldn't the people visiting from Los Angeles couldn't get out onto the beach. And that was in a newspaper article in the LA Times. So we know for sure that it happened. And it's not, oral history that was passed down. It's documented. And so with that, the business thrived until 1924 in a remote area of Manhattan Beach on the northern edge of what was then the town, and far away from where most of the other people lived part-time and full-time, because at that point in time, the area was rural, and most of the people that had property down there had cottages, and they were only coming for weekend excursions, or, a few weeks in the summer, because it was a long way and there wasn't any employment down there. For most people, black or white. And so by the early 1920s, there were some folks who decided that they didn't like the fact that the black people were expanding with a small little community that was growing up around the Bruce's Resort. They didn't like the fact that there were all these visitors coming down there, and they used the excuse that it was going to impact real estate values. And they said there was a Negro invasion occurring. And at this point in time, this is when you are having a population jump in terms of the growth in Southern California and the Los Angeles area of white folks as well as black folks. And you have a heightened activity of the Ku Klux Klan around the nation and including in California, even though they weren't as violent and vicious in California as they were in other parts of the country. And someone was able to get the city council to implement an eminent domain proceeding to take the land away from the small African-American community that had developed around the Bruce's Lodge. And this is between 26th and 27th and between the Strand and Highland Avenue. And with that, they were successful. They had the eminent domain proceedings passed by 1924. And the Bruces and the other families that were impacted by it fought this proceeding, but they weren't able to prevail, and they were bought out of their property. And by 1925, everything was settled. And so the white folks got what they wanted. They chased the black people out. So at that point in time, you had less than 1,000 people that were living in Manhattan Beach. And in terms of these African Americans that had property there, it was less than 10 families in terms of the area where the Bruce's property was, including the Bruce's. It was 5 families. And so with that, they were able to get those families out, and they tried to then hide the memory of what was going on, to say that it was for a park, and they didn't build a park until the 1950s, and they tried to erase the memory of these African Americans that were there. Well, fast forward to more contemporary decades. In 2007, the park was renamed Bruce's Beach after the community did some hand-wringing, and it was proposed by the only black city councilman that has ever been in Manhattan Beach, that they change the name to recognize the pioneering Bruce family and the area that was known as Bruce's Beach. So they got that name change. And then fast forward to last year, the site became a site of consciousness and a site of healing and pilgrimage and celebratory events with different people after the murder of George Floyd. And the protests that were happening around the country to do with the racial reckoning that the nation was going through and is still going through. And with that, the city of Manhattan Beach was not unaffected by this. And the citizens and the public officials decided to take a new look at the plaque text that was there in on the plaque recognizing the park. And then a citizen who was living there decided with a group that she was involved in to suggest, she suggested that the Bruces should get their land back. And the group was called Justice for Bruce's Beach. And that whole idea became something that captured the imagination of County Supervisor Janice Hahn, because she had never heard about this history of Bruce's Beach before, and it turned out that the land that the Bruces had their lodge on, it was originally called Bruce's Lodge, was a part of her, the land that the county now owned that was on the beachfront. And so she decided that she wanted to return the land to the Bruce's family as part of her effort in racial reckoning and reparations. And so with that, right now, that story has captured national and global attention, and the return of the land to the Bruce's descendants is in process from the standpoint that in order for Supervisor Hahn and the other members of the Board of Supervisors to return this land to the Bruce family descendants, they have to go through some enabling legislation with the state of California, the state legislature, the Senate and the Assembly. And so they've had to go through some committee votes in the Assembly and a full vote, I'm sorry, committee votes in the Senate and a full vote of the Senate to advance this project. And then it's now in the Assembly. It's going through certain committees in the Assembly for a vote, and then the full Assembly will have to vote. And once that and whatever other things need to occur at the state level happen to make it a law, then it'll go to the governor's desk, and he will sign legislation to allow the county supervisors to give the land back to the Bruce family descendants, if that's what they decide that they're going to do. And at this point, they haven't, the county supervisors haven't said exactly how that land transfer would occur, but they have had their staffs look into it and had staff reports that were made public recently. We're now in mid-July of 2021 that so with that, we should be hearing sometime in the fall how all this land transfer to the Bruce family will take place. The one thing that is a through line from the 1920s to contemporary times in Manhattan Beach is that the racism of the era did chase out the black people. And you can see that in terms of the population numbers. Today, there are less than half a percent of the population in Manhattan Beach is African American. It's less than 200 folks that are in the census. So the white folks did what they wanted to in terms of keeping black people out of Manhattan Beach. And we must also look at the legacy of this history in a broader sense, aside from the families that lost in terms of their property, the African-American community lost a social economic space for the duration of the 20th century because the city was so hostile to them living there that they couldn't benefit from some of the employment opportunities that were in the aerospace industry and the oil industry that were nearby there because they couldn't live in that community and some of the other communities down that way. But we'll see what happens with that. And then one of the other sites that I cover in the book is Santa Monica. And Santa Monica has a historic African-American community that's been there since the founding of the town. And they initially were living in the beach neighborhoods south of and around where the current Civic Center is. And there was a beach area there near Pico and south to Bicknell that had different kinds of geographic places closer to Pico or closer to Bicknell, a few blocks south of Pico, depending on what particular time period you were you're talking about. And so this small African-American community staked its place there, and there were entrepreneurs that attempted to develop leisure space businesses for the emerging Black population that was growing in Los Angeles, and they would come to Santa Monica, and they were challenged by various racial exclusionary measures that inhibited this economic development and also residential expansion. But even with that, African Americans were able to maintain their beach usage because it was a public beach, even with the development that grew up around it in terms of the big white beach clubs. And they were able to maintain a small residential local community in Santa Monica that persists into the 20th century. It's not right by the beach anymore, but it does persist. And there is a historic African-American church that was formed in 1906, and they got their building in 1908, which is at 4th and Bay in Santa Monica. So it's four blocks from the beach, Phillips Chapel Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. You can drive by there and you can see it. And so this local African-American community's persistence has been important in the reclaiming of the memory here in the 21st century with various heritage conservation efforts and public history programming. And this programming has been initiated by various citizens groups. And my research has been foundational to some of these programs happening. The Bay Street Beach was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2019 as the Bay Street Beach Historic District, and it's the only historic district to be listed on the National Register in Santa Monica, and it's significant because of the African-American experience in American history. And it's also one of the few historic districts in California that is associated with Black people or any people of color. And the Belmar History Plus Art Project was recently completed to commemorate the African-American experience in Santa Monica with an outdoor exhibition, with an outdoor exhibition that's in the new park and sports field area at 4th and Pico, the historic Belmar Park. There's like 20 historic panels and a large sculpture by April Banks. There is also lesson plans that have been developed, which will be available soon. There's a context essay, which is available now. You can look at that on my website. There were community engagement programs that went on over the last year and a half, even in the virtual space. And then there was also some youth art programs that occurred as well. And so that's something for people to go and look at. And then another place that I explore in depth in the book is Lake Elsinore, which I mentioned earlier, which was the place that my family would go to. And this was a somewhat successful residential and leisure destination for the general population and for African Americans, even even in its marginality between the 1910s to the 1960s. And it was one of the farthest inland African American leisure destinations that was developed because the lake at in the area had changing dynamics over the 20th century, and there were changes in leisure tastes. that we don't see the African-American entrepreneurs resort business successes today, and we don't see the presence of their experience in the local history narratives and the landmark designation programs. And by not having the African-American experience in these programs, we're missing the opportunity to understand our full shared history of all of the different people that were involved in developing the area and their contributions to building California and the local Lake Elsinore community. And then one of the other places I look at in the book is the Park Ridge Country Club, which was in Corona, also in Riverside County. Lake Elsinore is in Riverside County as well. And this was a private club and leisure space that was originally built as built for a white-only constituency. And a group of very ambitious African-American businessmen purchased the site to operate as an interracial space and an attempt at building Black community suburbanization. And the local white citizens were very strenuous in their objections to this new venture in the Corona community. And the Black businessmen's efforts to build, to make this place a success have been left out of all the local history narratives. And so again, we're losing information about who was involved in developing the Corona community in terms of the historical actors and their efforts. And then another place that I look at in depth in the book is Eureka Villa, which later became known as Valverde, and it's in the Santa Clarita Valley area of northern Los Angeles County. And it was initially an African-American and white American resort development project, and it began in the mid-1920s. And at this time, there were also some other land development projects that were competing for dollars with Eureka Villa for African Americans' patronage and their dollars. And in terms of Eureka Villa, Valverde, public money contributed to making a park and a swimming pool, and multiple marketing campaigns by both white and Black boosters helped to keep this place interesting for African American consumers until the racial apartheid era ended in the 1960s. And in contemporary times, the Valverde community, as it's known, has been reclassed as one of the last rural areas remaining where there's affordable housing in the Santa Clarita Valley, and there's not a whole lot of memory about the African American heritage there. And I look at a few other places also in the book. One of the big things I am interested in people realizing about these sites is that there were some really interesting African-American folks of all different classes that were involved in using these places and attempting to develop them, and also in looking at trying to take advantage of the California dream in terms of real estate development. And in my work, I'm looking at reclaiming and reinserting these communities into the regional landscape so that we have a better understanding of the history of the area and, you know, having these sites get incorporated into public memory, because that's going to help to broaden our sense of as Californians and Americans, broaden our sense of our identity here in the region. And hopefully the book and these different programs that I've been involved in to help with the reinsertion of this information, reclaiming these places in terms of the African American experience, will help the communities to also realize that these stories are important to think about in terms of how they are developing new strategies in terms of contemporary times about how to, you know, work with different people in claiming civic in developing civic engagement.
And as we saw with the example of Bruce's Beach as well, that often, you know, reframing these places and telling different stories about these places and, you know, reinserting truths into these places, it can lead to real material change as well. And in this particular case, into the transference of actual land from one person to other people. So, you know, these stories really do a good job of showing how the way that we talk about place and the histories of places, that it matters a great deal, that it's not it changes things. That, and I think that your book does a really good job of showing that.
Yes, it does change things when people read the information. Yes. And also for us as historians, the stories that I tell in my book validate what we know, is that the past influences the present,
right?
And the present will influence the future. So the past has consequences for the future. I mean, for the present and the future. And we can't get away from that. Although some people would like to tell you, "Oh, history's worthless," but that we know as historians is not true.
Yeah. So you did a great job of going over kind of a bird's eye view of the most of the content of the book. And as I said earlier, there's a lot of wrinkles and smaller stories within there. So definitely go buy the book and read it for yourselves. But I have one more kind of final question before we wrap up and ask some kind of wrap-up questions. It's about the book itself. And one thing that I noticed is that a lot of these sites share a similar story. You have African-American leisure sites that are contested by racist white Californians. And eventually these stories are retold by white Californians about these places to be primarily white narratives about white places. Why do you think white Californians are often so reluctant to remember the actual history of these places? Why, I guess, this retelling in a way that removes the black story from these sites? Why does this keep happening in place after place like this?
Well, why does it happen in American history?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the question, right?
It's not just a problem in terms of local history that African-American stories are left out of the American narrative. So it's unfortunate, but, you know, the white supremacist values devalued the African American experience, unless it was something that was purely supporting what the white folks wanted. So it's a problem of the American experience that we do not fully recognize our history. It's not the contestation narrative in terms of whites contesting Black participation goes back to the kind of value that whites are thinking Black people are only laborers and should be seen and not heard, and whites don't want to give up power to a broader population. So that is something that's national, not just regional.
So again, kind of looking at the book as a whole, and I like to ask my guests this, and sometimes they express a little bit of frustration because it's not an easy question, but I'm curious, what is one takeaway that you hope readers come away from your book understanding? And I ask that, you know, knowing that there's a lot of different takeaways that someone could come away from this book with, but what do you hope that readers come away understanding about this topic?
Well, I hope that people take a broader look at what is American history and understand that in terms of these stories that I'm talking about, although they are revolving around places of leisure, they still have much more complicated stories to tell about African-American migration, about socioeconomic status, about human experiences that people were having, about economic development. And these are the local stories that contribute to a broader narrative about who we are as Americans, and also to the national movement to open up recreation for everyone. And these stories show that that liberty was not just about socioeconomic and political issues, but it was also about liberty and freedom, but it was also about liberty. These stories were also about being able to have free time and do what you want with your free time. So I use these leisure sites as a way to get into sharing these broader narratives in a different way than just, you know, doing a book about migration or doing a book about, Black entrepreneurs.
That's one of the things I actually really loved about this book, is that even though it's wrapped up in all these larger issues, that fundamentally it's a book about people having fun or trying to have fun or wanting to have fun. And I think that's an understudied topic in history, is people wanting to go out and enjoy themselves, say on the beach or at a country club, for instance. And I really appreciated that was kind of the central core of this book.
Well, I thank you. I'm glad that you saw that, because that was also one of the reasons that I was inspired to write the book, because when I was growing up, my parents were divorced, and we didn't go on overnight vacations where we were going to spend the night at a new place as a family, either with my mother or my father, for the most part, because since my parents were divorced, they would take us on day trips, but they weren't, you know, taking us overnight. And I always was kind of fascinated with that, because there were other people around me who were doing these overnight, vacations. Like my cousins were going different places around the country with their families, and I always wondered about that. And so in looking at these leisure sites here in Southern California, that was part of my interest to tell these stories.
And then finally, I always like to end the show by getting a preview of what my guests are working on next. So do you have any other projects that you are starting? I know a lot of the work that you've been talking about is ongoing, and I know that you're beginning a new position in just about 2 months, but what are you working on next?
So right now, we mentioned I'm going to start working as a, I'm going to start an opportunity as a guest scholar in residency at the Getty Institute, and I'm going to continue my study of African Americans and sites related to their experiences in the coastal zone, particularly in Venice, California. And I'm beginning a I'm beginning to plan a new exhibition around the subject matter of my book with the California African American Museum at Exposition Park in Los Angeles that will go up in December 2022. I'm also working on some youth field trips to some of the sites that I discuss in the book with the Santa Monica Conservancy and Outward Bound Adventures, which is a youth development organization where they take kids into the outdoors. And there's a few other things that are kind of percolating, but those are the ones that are the most formed at this point in time.
So you're keeping busy, basically, is what I'm hearing here.
I am keeping busy, yes. And inspired.
Yes, yes, yes. Dr. Allison Rose Jefferson is an independent historian and heritage conservation consultant. She is currently the scholar in residence with the Institute for the Study of Los Angeles at Occidental College. And beginning in September, she will be the guest scholar in residency at the Getty Conservation Institute. And her latest book is Living the California Dream: African American Leisure Sites During the Jim Crow Era, which came out in 2020 with the University of Nebraska Press. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Allison, and thank you for writing this book.
Oh, and thank you, Stephen, so much for inviting me to participate in the program.